me. Technical.
I think I did bad one. Let's see.
Hopefully not. Nope, that's me.
Yep. Okay, I did good.
First, before I go on, I'd like to disclose that I have no financial interests related to this project. I'm sure by the fourth day you all are tired of hearing of that. The title of my study was The Influence of the Home, School, and Community Context on Childhood Obesity. It was a multi-level study and is very data-heavy. I'll try to bring some levity to that because it seems like we have a diverse audience. Do some explanation, but also just some overview as well. So the purpose of this study was to examine the ecological influences of the home, school, and community context on childhood obesity from kindergarten through fifth grade using secondary analysis of data from the Early Childhood Longitudinal Study. It's also known as the ECLSK, which is a restricted use data set from the National Center for Education Statistics. I think we all know the background and relationship to childhood obesity. You've probably heard it multiple times over the course of the presentations here at APHA if you've had the pleasure of attending. But one of the things that's not necessarily always highlighted are that interventions to treat childhood obesity have been successful in the short term, but really data to support long-term maintenance of reduced weight is limited. And to combat this concern, the focus on childhood obesity research really needs to turn to more of a prevention model. Childhood obesity is influenced by biological moderators such as genetics, sociocultural moderators such as ethnicity, socioeconomic status, and behavioral mediators, including nutrition, physical activity, and sedentary behaviors. But while biological moderators consist of individual characteristics in which children, families, communities generally can't change, some can, but generally unable to be changed, behavioral mediators are one thing where we can focus on an area of prevention. So, similar to you all's model, the conceptual framework for this research was based off of Bronfenbrenner's model, ecological model of human development. In this perspective, a child's development is influenced by the ecological environment. The ecological environment includes a system of contexts. I look specifically at the home, the school, and the community, and each context in the child's development is influenced by the intra as well as interrelationships among the contexts. So the model shown here shows congruency between Bronfenbrenner's theory, previous childhood obesity research, as well as constructs that were contained within the data set. So current childhood obesity research is typically limited to relationships within separate contexts. They're either typically limited to studies in the home, studies in the school, and with even more limitations, studies in the community as a whole. Those studies that did look at the home and the school context, the vast majority failed to conform to behavior-specific ecological contexts for assessing children across environments. So with this said, it's the latter studies that were primarily school-based studies. They collected information on the home context, but really used those variables as covariates and not explanatory variables in the model. So more as controlling factors. So the primary aim of this study was to investigate the multidimensional correlates of childhood obesity within the home, school, and community contexts in relationship to nutrition, physical activity, and sedentary behaviors. Because it is a secondary data set, I'll explain a little bit about initial data collecting procedures and then explain what I did to draw my sample from that data set. The primary base year sample from the ECLSK was composed of 22,782 kindergartners who began school during the 1998-99 school year in the United States. The primary sampling was derived via a dual-frame multi-stage design where they first picked 100 primary sampling units, and primary sampling units were either counties or groups of counties. Then within those primary sampling units, schools were selected systematically, and kindergartners were then sampled within each school using equal probability sampling techniques. There were approximately 23 to 24 kindergartners per school, and to That was the basis for the initial data set collection from the National Centers for Education Statistics. In addition to obtain the data, obviously I had to go through rigorous internal and external application processes. Being restricted data, there was a lot of information, confidential information, that was contained within the data set that required background checks, not only from, or confidentiality checks, I should say, not only from internal IRB review, which I'll go into in a minute, but also making a rigorous application to the federal government as well. It was a 9-month procedure for me to get the data from the start of application to actually receiving it to my desktop. Some of that may have to do with working with the government as well. So now moving on to the current study, I took an unweighted sample from the ECLSK data set. It was composed of 19,634 kindergartners, all children who had BMI scores in kindergarten, third grade, and fifth grade data waves after data cleaning were included in the data analysis for the current study. Data cleaning involved the creation of standardized BMI Z-scores using LMS parameters from the CDC. And what I did was looked at, there aren't a lot of great definitions with regards to nutritional data on where you should set cutoff points for outliers. It was Tulane University's recommendation that I, through a recommendation I found, I guess, at Tulane, that I set them at 4 standard deviations above and below the mean. And outliers were also looked at in relationship to dramatic increases or decreases in BMI scores from each data wave. So ultimately, there were 161 BMI scores that were excluded in kindergarten, 60 in third grade, and 32 in fifth grade. This table shows the demographic characteristics of this sample. You can see that girls and boys were equally sampled and remained so despite attrition through all the data waves. You can also see that attrition did not significantly affect the distribution of ethnicities as well. While children who were white, African American, as well as Hispanic were sampled similarly to that of the U.S. population, the study actually oversampled children, children of Asian descent, Native American, and Alaska Natives, also oversampled Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander children. And that allowed researchers that were specifically interested in those subgroups to do analyses specific to them. This is a continuation of the previous table showing more different demographic information in relationship to socioeconomic status. Attrition did affect this to some degree in the third grade and fifth grade data rounds, resulted in fewer children in the first quintile of socioeconomic status with slightly more children in the fifth quintile. And this shows some BMI distribution in relationship to prevalence of the sampled children. All weight categories, again, were based on CDC recommendations. And as you can see, the prevalence of childhood obesity in the sampled children doubled from kindergarten to fifth grade. And this, as we all know, closely resembles what was going on in the United States as well during this time frame. So in secondary data analysis, there are methodological considerations that we have to pay attention to, and those include both conceptual as well as methodological considerations. The conceptual considerations included data set selection, theory selection, variable selection. I apologize, that's listed on there twice. And reliability and validity of the original data collection procedures. And then the methodological considerations included sampling methods, instruments, data cleaning, handling missing data, as well as statistical analyses. Because this was a nested model, I'll go into a little bit more about how I conducted data analysis consistent with both the theory as well as the data set. So from the various assessment batteries in the ECLSK, subscales were created to measure nutrition, physical activity, and sedentary behaviors in the home environment, in the school environment, and in the community environments. Internal consistencies are listed for you on this slide, and they were analyzed at each data wave. The coefficient alpha for fifth graders are reported for the home on this slide, and then for the school and community context on the next slide. And although the internal consistencies, as you can see, for several measures were low to moderate, particularly with regards to the community context, these measures were retained in this exploratory research because they were consistent with the conceptual framework as well as previous research. recognizing it's a limitation. So moving on to data analysis and my methods, demographic information was analyzed using SPSS 14.0 and hierarchical linear modeling was used to examine the multidimensional correlates of childhood obesity within the context of the home, school, and community environments in relationship to nutrition, physical activity, and sedentary behaviors. A two-level model was established to examine the relationships among these contexts. Data were analyzed using STATA 9 to construct random intercept models with the child's BMI as the dependent variable and the school identification number as the grouping variable at the level two, on level two of the model. Maximum likelihood estimates were obtained for each variable of interest in the home, school, and community. And interclass correlation coefficients were analyzed to determine the contextual effects of the school environment on childhood obesity with child-level covariates, as well as explanatory variables within each context, so the home, school, and community. Interclass correlation coefficients, for those of you that may not be aware of what they are used to measure variances of children's BMI scores in the same school relative to variances in BMI scores in other schools, so it creates a within cluster or within school correlation. And then from this, unconditional and conditional models were both analyzed. Unconditional models were those without any child-level covariates or explanatory variables in the model. And then obviously the conditional models added the child-level covariates and explanatory variables of nutrition, physical activity, and sedentary behavior. Oh, I'm going to move ahead. I had our IRB approval. Oh, I didn't see off to my right. This represents the unconditional model with no child-level covariates or explanatory variables in the school context. And you can see that the results indicate that schools accounted for 3% variability in BMI in kindergarten year, 4% in the third grade year, and 6% variability in the fifth grade year. A lot of data here. Why don't I do this? And you guys trust me on this because I've got 5 minutes left and I obviously talked a lot faster when I was practicing. Not to run through the data, I'm going to give you my summary statements instead. Does anyone opposed? Okay. So with relationship to the child-level covariates, BMI scores were significantly higher and increased over time for the following children. So again, that's looking over time with these children and specifically within these groups. BMI increased for children who were African American, children who were Hispanic, American Indian, Alaska Native, as well as those in a lower socioeconomic status, which is consistent with the data that we know exists. These are the home explanatory variables. If anyone wants these slides, I did upload them, so you'll be able to see them independently at your leisure. But the explanation of this, BMI scores, it was interesting, were lower for children who ate breakfast together as a family, supporting that family, the importance of family, who participated in regular physical activity, had decreased television time. Again, most of these things are consistent with other data that's in the literature. But interestingly enough, ate more fast foods, and I'll get to that. I'm sure there'll be a question. And BMI scores were higher for children who consumed more salad. I'll get to that, too, because that'll be a question always. at least it was for my committee. These are the school-level explanatory variables. What was interesting is the explanatory variables were measured from a child perspective in fifth grade, as well as in all grades, an administrator perspective. So I'll give you the explanation of those. BMI scores were higher for fifth graders who had available at school sugar-sweetened beverages, which was child-reported in the fifth grade, vending machines, which was administrator-reported in all grades, and ice cream, which was also administrator-reported. And BMI scores were lower for fifth graders who had bread products available at school. And unfortunately, PE and recess in this study did not significantly contribute to the model. The community context was a little bit, it was interesting in relationship to some of the things that were assessed, but within the community context, BMI scores were higher for children living in rural locations. Again, that's consistent with other research that is out there. I had a measure of food security, also physical out, activity outlets. So are kids out playing at the park, going to the local Y? Lots of questions in relationship to that. And neighborhood safety. And unfortunately, none of those variables significantly contributed to the model. And then I did a full model. So with regards to the full model, and this included child-level covariates as well as variables from the home, the school, and community. So what was interesting is the BMI scores continued to still be lower for children who ate breakfast together as a family, participated in regular physical activity, had decreased television time, and unfortunately that fast food thing's still there. The BMI scores were higher for children who had ice cream available at school, lived in rural locations, and consumed more salad and fruits. And again, I'll get to that in a minute. Survey, self-report. I think that's probably the gist of that's the negative impact. I can swing it to a It's a lot of it is presuming and assumptions, but I'll answer that question when it comes. So as you can see, sociocultural moderators are having the most significant influence on the variability in BMI, and that's consistent, again, with the literature in relationship to ethnicity and socioeconomic status. While certainly the impact of the home seems to have very protective effects over the variability in BMI seen in this group of children. The school, on the other hand, didn't identify the protective effects that I was hoping that it would. So again, recess PE didn't significantly contribute to the models, but ice cream vending machines did contribute to the model. And the community context, the rural location, again, was the factor contributing to the model. So obviously there are implications for this research in relationship to things that we can do as individuals interested in school health or interprofessional individuals interested in school health, obviously looking more at coordinated school health programs and how those might, we might use this data to look at current wellness programs that are going on in our communities. And it also, on top of just local communities, has impact for health policy issues at the state federal level. And certainly the data shows that tailored intervention towards disparate groups are warranted.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is that yours?
I think when you're standing up here, the 20 minutes go so quickly, you don't realize it. Do the presenters want to just come up to the front? And, well, Suzanne, you're helping Catherine, correct? We can sit. We have a few minutes because we have one less presenter, but we'll take questions from the Go ahead.
With apologies for not having any voice this morning. On those last papers, a couple of things. First, BMI is not only a measure of obesity, it's a measure of body mass.
Absolutely.
And a lot of the kids between the age of 85th and 90th, speaking as a practicing clinician, 85th and 90th are muscular kids.
Absolutely.
So
I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner, so I'm practicing clinician as well.
Time to go home and get a meal until so late at night it's too late.
I like your positive outlook. Yes. Well, obviously my dissertation committee aside, but
and there are fast foods now that sell healthy foods. So.
There are, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes, including
salad.
Yes.
Again, not having access to these kids like I wanted to have access to these kids, if self-report bias existed, certainly when we're looking at, not so much in kindergarten, but by the time we're getting to third and fifth grade, we've got health education curriculum that are hopefully impacting our kids' understanding of what nutritional items are available to them and what they should be doing. And it could have been a reflection of a child's belief in what they should be engaging in rather than what they were actually engaging in. And truly, with any survey data, you have to report that there's self-report bias.
Any other questions?
I do.
Okay.
Actually, I've moved out of the school age realm and really interested in early care and education. So you're engaging students, which I found some with me. But are you currently using in the program at all Caring for Our Children, which is the national standard?
Oh, yeah.
Right to here. So how are you implementing Caring for Our Children or the national standards for health and education safety in out-of-home child care settings? Mm-hmm. I'm a child care health consultant, too. Mm-hmm. We're a number of hats, way too many faculty nursing people may know. We just keep piling it on.
Exactly.
I'm actually 45% in Head Start and 80% at San Francisco.
Okay,
State, so
you understand pylons.
Yeah, the pylon.
Right. So how are you using it with your students?
Well, I have to tell you, I've actually pulled back from Caring for Our Children momentarily.
Okay.
Because we had incorporated Caring for Our Children standards in our monitoring tool at the Head Start.
Okay.
Yeah,
but it
became way too complex in having findings at our centers based upon Caring for Our Children, where we really needed to go to community care licensing standards, performance standards. Because when we do a finding, we really have to, you know, back it up with, you know, what regulation are we violating, and so it was mixed together. Not that I'm abandoning a higher standard, but being 1 year on the job, I really felt, well, we need to get some baseline standards real clear, and then we can incorporate the higher standard of caring for our children as recommendation and goals to go for.
Correct.
I hear you speaking to it because so many states recognize, and even within the resources of early care and education, the impetus to move to a higher standard when states aren't accepting of that higher standard. Mm-hmm.
Right. So one of my strategies that I put into our 3-year strategic plan is the child care health program in California, which trains child care health consultants, which I was trained. The curriculum I'm bringing to all of our centers for the center directors and the family advocates. So I'm starting with our GOP next month. We'll be inaugurating that. I'll get through the entire curriculum for them, and then I'll be taking it to our delegates and partners. So that will start giving me the basis to go to the higher standard.
Yes.
I noticed that they always try to cover the ASVL, including Asperger's. Is Asperger's diagnosed differently than the more severe forms of ASD? How does that fit in?
No, I think what's happening with Asperger's is that there's a lot of children who aren't actually being diagnosed with Asperger's until much later, because they can look very typical until you start to get to some of the more complex social situations that they have to navigate. Because Asperger's children, or children who have Asperger's, their core deficit is in socialization. So their communication, their language skills are very different from a child who may only have 2 or 3 words. And so when they're getting into those more social situations, first, second, third grade, that's when those children are actually being identified and they're being differentiated from kids who have ADHD or ABD, and so there's actually a lot of children who are being diagnosed first with like a PDD diagnosis, and then they're moving out of that into like a preschool ADHD or an ABD diagnosis for any number of reasons. I had a family that, mom never took her children out, and so when he was around other children, looked very autistic. But then, he's in a Head Start program and really got to be around other kids, and 7 months later, they took the diagnosis away. So I think that, I'm not sure why exactly, and you do see that. I mean, they're always kind of pulling Asperger's out of that, and there is talk about whether or not Asperger's will actually be taken out of sort of the autism spectrum at some later point, so I'm not sure.
Good questions. Anyone else? Yes. Yes, sir.
This is another question for Suzanne. I talked with Kathy out in the hall, and she said you've used the MCHAP, and you also were looking for 5 behaviors. One of them was pointing, or, just that children be able to complete.
Yeah, like children should be able to to points to, you know, a desire, you know, pointing at something, having joint attention, being able to look at something that is, you know, kind of far away. Also, showing and sharing. I mean, we have kids that will play, you know, I always ask families, I say, what do your children like to play with? Oh, they like to play with cars. Well, my next question is, how do they play with cars? Because many of them are turning the cars upside down and spinning the wheels. That's not playing with a car. That's self-stimulatory behavior. Unless they're doing a variety of other things, but when you have a child that's just doing that. So, there, and then there's the social smile, and,
Stacking blocks.
And stacking, yes. Exactly.
Sharing. They need to share it too.
Yeah. You know, looking at a toy, I mean, you know, when you think about kids, even before they have language, you know, you see a really cool toy, and what's the first thing that a lot of them do? Like, they're like, wow, like, you know, this cool toy, but, you know, I'll sit in evaluations for an hour with kids and they never look up. And eye contact is also another issue. But interestingly enough, lately I've actually had a number of children who are diagnosed who have fantastic eye contact. And I don't know if that's because it's been identified and taught, which is interesting because you'll have kids that will have great eye contact, but it's like for very prescribed periods of time and they're waiting for that reinforcement at the end. They're like, I know if I look at you for a certain number of seconds, I'm going to get something out of it. So it's not necessarily natural, and so we end up with a lot of kids who later on are just staring at people.
Well, any other questions? This has been great for me because when I go back home, I have a little bit of head start, and I have a little bit of obesity, and I have the nurse family partnership. So when I go back home to my own life, what I've learned today will certainly take back all those to my work practice, and I think for you, I hope so as well. And it's been a great day, and I've loved the fact that we've had some case management as well as some evidence-based stuff developing as well as coalitions and the, all the stuff we have to do in school. So I thank you for your time today, and I think it was a nice balance, and I appreciate it. I hope you have a great time at the rest of the conference. And see you in Philadelphia, which will be home of Suzanne next year. So.
And the MSP is great with Sharon, but I'm Thank you.
Well, you were very familiar to me. Thank you very much.